It's the Paul Harris Show for a Friday afternoon on the Big 550 KTRS. You can email me, paul@harrisonline.com. Follow me on Twitter, at Paul Harris Show. Max is here with me as well. You can follow him on Twitter, at Max on Movies, and catch his Saturday night Max on Movies show as well. And this is the hour in which we talk about movies and other showbiz-related stuff. And we have only seen one of the movies that's opening up this weekend. It's called Murder on the Orient Express. The title is its own spoiler. The Orient Express is a train, and there's a murder on board.
Well, then why even see it? I mean, what are they doing?
The movie is based on an Agatha Christie novel from 1934, and I'm not exactly sure the era it takes place in, but it's got to be the 20s or 30s, right?
30s.
Okay.
Yep.
So why don't you tell the plot, and then we'll get into discussing it.
I think this has to be Agatha Christie's most popular novel, her most famous novel. I'm convinced everybody already knows the outcome, the whodunit, if you will.
No, I disagree. I think a lot of people have never heard of this, never read it, never saw the last movie version of it,
which was
30-plus years ago.
This is what 40. I realized after I saw the screening. Uh-huh. I realized, wait a minute, I'm way more familiar with all of this than anybody else at this screening.
Yeah.
As I was saying earlier today when I was on with Jennifer Blohm and John Grayson, when I was growing up, my mom was a big fan of Masterpiece Mystery, and this used to bore me to tears when I was 10, 11, 12, watching all of these British, stuffy detectives, and I couldn't care less, and I would grab my He-Man toys or my Transformer toys and just kind of kill some time while she was watching her stories, basically. Mm-hmm. But the ones that always grabbed me were the Hercule Poirot stories starring David Suchet as Agatha Christie's most famous detective, who was sort of a shameless ripoff by her own admission of Sherlock Holmes. He was this insufferable Belgian who thought way too highly of himself, and but he became
who else would introduce themselves as the world's greatest detective?
Absolutely, yes. And so there's a lot of Holmes going on here. She wrote that character for almost 30 years and published a lot of different short stories and novels featuring him, even after she was sick of the character because the publishers kept saying, they're selling, write us another one. Towards the end, she would write a disconnected mystery story and then have the editor just put in Poirot's name.
Really?
Because she was so sick of him. And finally, she wrote the last Poirot story called Curtain, which is phenomenal. Anyway, growing up watching these stories, I became a big fan. I read a bunch of the books, including Orient Express. And just last year, Netflix decided to put up all of the A&E Masterpiece Poirot stories. Over the course of 25 years, Paul, David Suchet filmed every single adaptation of every word that Agatha Christie wrote about this detective. So it took me almost a year, but I watched all of them.
Wow.
And people always bring up the Sidney Lumet directed version of Orient Express from 1974,
yep,
which is very good. But the David Suchet version is, for me, the definitive version of this story.
Okay.
So there's my background. So I'm going to see this as somebody who loves this character. I don't quite know if Kenneth Branagh can pull it off. And again, I was convinced everybody would be bored by the reveal because, of course, everybody else has also read the book, watched the adaptations.
No.
Right? Oh, that's right.
No.
Oh, they haven't.
No, they haven't.
They haven't. And so what I was struck by with this adaptation is how classic it felt. It feels like an old school epic movie. Not necessarily overblown, but it takes its time. I like the pacing. It's a very slow pace. And it was shot with the same cameras that Chris Nolan used for Dunkirk, which also starred Kenneth Branagh. Mm-hmm. He had a role in that, and I guess he was taken by those cameras and said, I'm going to do that same thing. So you had these great 70 millimeter shots, which are not going to look the same on your television, and they also do a couple of things with the train that are different than the adaptations we've seen before. Now, in the Sidney Lumet version, you had an all-star cast. You had Vanessa Redgrave and Anthony Perkins. You had Albert Finney as the detective.
Lauren Bacall, Martin Balsam, Ingrid Bergman, Jacqueline Bisset, Sean Connery, John Gielgud, Anthony Perkins, Vanessa Redgrave, Michael York, Richard Widmark.
And
Ingrid, I looked it up today.
And Ingrid Bergman won Best Supporting Actress for her role. Her role in this adaptation is played by Penelope Cruz. The Lauren Bacall role is played by Michelle Pfeiffer. Mm-hmm. And so as Poirot, I didn't know what to make of Brana at first. He was directing this, and I like him as a director a whole lot. I like his Shakespeare adaptations like Henry V and Hamlet. I liked his Cinderella a couple years ago, the live-action version. I like his Thor. So I thought, okay, you're going to do a good job with this, but I didn't know about him playing this short, stout little Belgian because it's such a strange role. Now, Peter Ustinov played him a couple of times back in the day, Murder Under the Sun and Death on the Nile, playing him more as a bumbling Watson type for laughs, and I really don't like that. I liked what Finney did, though, you know, always pruning his mustache and being very reserved. I will compare Ken Branagh here to, of all things, a comic book character, of course, because this is what I do. Hugh Jackman was cast as Wolverine in the X-Men films. Comic book fans know that Wolverine is 5 foot one, okay? But Hugh Jackman's not 5 foot one. He's a tall, strapping guy, but he embodied that character, the soul of that character. And for me, being a fan of this character, I thought Ken Branagh was fantastic, except he's not fat. And that's okay. I wish he would have maybe worn a fat suit or something.
Perhaps, but for people who haven't read the book or seen all the other versions you've seen, yes. Yeah, they won't care.
And I think he gets the character exactly right. Some of the things that I've heard that people have an issue with in this film is that this giant cast, and by the way, he's put together a great cast. He's got, as I said, Penelope Cruz. He's got Daisy Ridley from the Star Wars films, Josh Gad from Frozen, and Beauty and the Beast in a dramatic role. You've also got Leslie Odom Jr. from Hamilton.
Judy Dench, Willem Dafoe, Derek Jacobi,
who is phenomenal as well. And so I like Johnny the whole cast. But people were saying, well, the cast is sort of underdeveloped. You don't get to know them too much. Well, that's true, because when you read a Christie book, you're really reading it because of Poirot. Just like when you read a Holmes story, it's a lot about Holmes. And so, yes, this movie does focus more on the detective than the actual suspects. But that's kind of the point of this story.
But if I read the book, I guarantee you there would be reveals throughout the book about more about each of these characters. We would probably hear little mini plots about what they've been involved in their life and how they came to be in this place, which is essential to how he solves the crime at the end. And when he does solve it, it seems like he's just pulling stuff out of the air, because that's the way mysteries sometimes have to play out, because they can't give us a full book. They can't give us a 6-hour movie about these characters. They have to squeeze it in. And to me, that made the ending disappointing. Even though I had seen the 74 original, I never read the books, but I saw the Sidney Lumet version in 74, and it was okay. I was looking forward to something even better, even though I knew the ending. It's disappointing, because all of a sudden
they make a decision. There is a piece of information about something. I don't want to even go down that road.
Right.
And they make the decision to wait about halfway through the movie to introduce this, and then everything kind of goes into high gear. In the book, there are elements, of course, earlier to kind of ensnare the reader.
Yeah.
But both Arthur Conan Doyle and Agatha Christie were guilty for something in their mysteries. They let the detective pull out a piece of information that the reader did not have. And so these are not books that you read so you yourself could try to figure them out. If you've read a Holmes story, it's impossible to figure out that Holmes is going to connect 2 plus 2. And so they do that in this movie.
Did you ever see a Neil Simon movie called Murder by Death?
I have not. And I know it's a parody of all of these. They have a lot of the different.
Basically, it's about all these fancy mystery writers who are called together to a mansion in the middle of nowhere. And the person who did it, we find out, the reason the person did that was because all of these people have written all these books in which the ending brought in new information that had not been in the previous 300 pages. And the last 2 pages, the detective always solves the crime with stuff that you, the reader, could never have solved. And that's how I felt at the end of Murder on the Orient Express.
You are not incorrect. An Agatha Christie story or even a Conan Doyle story is much more about the detective and what they're going through and the questions that they have, the quandaries, than it is trying to divine who done it. And I think if you're going to this to try to figure out, okay, well, I think it was this person or that person, then like Paul, you will be let down. But if you love this character like me, and you like old school kind of filmmaking, I love the pacing of this. I thought the score was great. Josh Gad is wonderful. Daisy Ridley is wonderful. I don't think this movie is going to do very well because there was a younger couple next to me at the screening who about 25-ish minutes or so into it just got up and walked out.
Yep.
And I think that this is it's such a leisurely movie that I think that in this era of quick edits, I think it's going to lose a lot of people.
You say leisurely. I'm with that couple. I'm using the word boring.
Oh, no.
And again, boring. I knew what the story was and I knew where it was going to go.
Sure.
But it just takes forever to get there.
I like the pace.
I would not be surprised if you heard snoring in the theater for this. Now, there are a couple of other things I got to say about this, because I know you liked it more than I did.
Yes, I liked it a lot.
Okay. The plot, which we didn't mention, one of the passengers on this elite train is murdered. Apparently, there are only 13 people allowed on this train. It's ridiculous. It's a highly expensive train that goes from Istanbul to Calais in France and stops along the way.
At the time, though, given the weather and given the region, it would have been strange for anybody to be on that train. And again, that's laid out in the book that that this was sort of an emergency.
Okay, but we get this dozen passengers. You got a mobster, you got a princess, you got a governess, you got a doctor, you got an American loudmouth, you got an Italian car salesman, you get an English butler, a German maid, a French conductor, a Swedish nurse. And what I just told you is more than you find out in the movie about most of them. And it is so stunningly slow. It might be great as a book, because you can read that at a leisurely pace. You can read a couple of chapters, put it down, come back, fill in more of the holes about who all these people were. But in a movie like this, you would think that they had to rush to get all the information in. No. Let me just put it this way. At one point, the train is stopped by an avalanche. Mm-hmm. So is the movie.
Oh, no, that's one of the most pivotal parts when the train is stopped and they all have to get off and they don't know
but
what's going on.
But the plot of the movie doesn't move any faster than the train caught in the avalanche.
This movie reminded me of something like a lazy Sunday, kind of. It's raining outside.
No, no,
you
I like lazy
on.
Sundays.
I think that's what this movie is. It's like a comforting blanket. You put it on and just spend your Sunday watching this. I like this film a whole
this
lot.
This is like sitting down with a blanket and looking out the window at the rain. For two straight hours.
No. I think it's much better.
Now, I will say one good thing about the movie. Beautiful cinematography. Mm-hmm. And I'm guessing CGI as well, because that train and that trestle can't possibly really
especially
exist.
The trestle, right. Exactly,
and it's, yeah. I mean,
which was a new invention for this.
Yeah, and it's really beautiful. And I thought Branagh did a pretty good job directing it. You're moving through a relatively claustrophobic space. Uh-huh. And
he sets up the geography of the train. You can tell where everybody is at any given
time. And even when he takes us outside the train and we see a shot... There's one shot of a person on the train where the camera starts below and then mm-hmm. moves up, and then you see them from above. And there's one entire scene that is shot from a perspective you don't see in many movies, which is directly
overhead.
Above the action. Yeah. That's very clever, and that's very good. I have no problem with that. I just wish they would have moved it along. If I'd been on board this train like I was in this movie, I would have said, can we get going already?
So I don't expect this movie to do very well because of its leisurely pace. I think Thor Ragnarok, which is funny, it's the second sequel to a movie that Branagh directed, Thor. I think that one will actually win the box office this weekend. And it's too bad for those like myself who enjoy this genre and enjoyed this movie specifically, because at the end, they have a nice nod to the audience about another adventure that he could go on. And Branagh has said if this does well, he would like to reprise the character. That's not going to happen.
Well, the movie sets him up for a sequel, for Death of the Nile.
Yep.
One of the more, I think it's the most blatant lead for a sequel since Back to the Future.
It could be. But you know what? That one did take place after Orient Express. There's somebody on that ship, actually, that has heard about the events of what would be the last film. I don't think it's going to happen.
I think this movie is going to have bad word of mouth. I think there will be people who, like me, were looking forward to seeing it, especially with some of the names that are attached to it. I like seeing these people on screen, although I was not thrilled with Johnny Depp. I don't know what happened to his career. I still remember him being so good in Donnie Brasco and Ed Wood and Don Juan DeMarco and even Blow.
Thankfully, though, I would say for the people out there who don't enjoy Johnny Depp anymore, because that seems to be the majority of people.
He seems to want to impress everybody with what a great actor he is, and he overdoes it.
But he's also not in the film for very long.
Well, yeah.
So I wouldn't have to worry about that too much.
But he has made some terrible choices and roles in the last 20 years or so. And my last comment about this movie is you do not have to stick around for the song that is sung over the closing credits, written by Kenneth Branagh and sung by Michelle Pfeiffer.
That's right.
My wife told me that as we were walking out. She said, I think that's Michelle Pfeiffer. I said, really? She said, yeah, don't you remember? She can sing from Fabulous Baker Boys. Don't you remember? And at that moment, I had a flashback to Michelle Pfeiffer in the red velvet dress, and I suddenly felt better than I had for the previous 2 hours.
That's what I thought of when I heard that song. I thought, oh, I guess Branagh's a fan of Baker Boys.
What do you give it on a scale of 10?
You are going to be so let down by this. I'm going to give this an 8. I loved this movie.
I know it makes it sound like I hated this movie, which would put it as one of my worst movies of the year list, but I'm going to give it a 4. I was somewhere in the 4 to 5 range, and the more I think about it, 4 out of 10. Yeah. And I will tell you this, if you're expecting a train to move along at a 10 and it moves along at a 4, you would be as annoyed as I am with the pace of Murder on the Orient Express. Also opening this weekend, Daddy's Home 2, which is a sequel to a movie that I didn't see in the first place.
I did not see Daddy's Home either, and I know it's been available for streaming the last couple of years. I have not ever wanted to click play, so I never
Mark
watched
Wahlberg.
It. Will Ferrell.
Will Ferrell.
This one's got...
Mel Gibson is in it.
Yes. And...
I can't remember who the fourth one is. Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
If you like the first one, you'll probably go see the sequel.
But Mel Gibson.
And it's one of those that's... It's
Are
it's
we all okay
proof.
With Mel Gibson being back now and making jokes?
This is the question I asked when Hacksaw Ridge did so well.
But Hacksaw Ridge, the audience members going to see it don't see Mel Gibson.
No, but you know it's directed by Mel Gibson, and he was nominated for an Academy Award.
Anytime those previews come on TV and he's like, ah, waka waka, I'm Mel Gibson, I think that people get a chill. I don't think it's going to play very well.
I do cringe. I will admit that. While I admired what he did with Hacksaw Ridge, I cringe when I see him in this. And there's another movie opening this weekend in St. Louis called Wonderstruck. What do you know about that?
Nothing.
Neither do I.
Anyway, I think we mentioned that last week, too. I have no idea.
And we didn't bother looking it up.
Heck no.
This is what IMDb is for, ladies and gentlemen.
We have to talk about I Love You, Daddy.
Oh,
maybe
yes.
When we come back.
That is the Louis C.K. movie that you'll never see. Well, not never. You're not going to see when they thought you'd see it, which was going to be next weekend. We'll talk about that. And I have Louis C.K.'s entire statement that he released this afternoon in which he admits he did do the things that these women said he did. That's coming up here on the Big 550 KTRS. It's the Big 550 KTRS. I am Paul Harris. Max is here with me. We're talking showbiz in this hour. Later on, of course, the Harris Challenge and knuckleheads in the news. Louis C.K. has responded to his accusers this afternoon in a statement that I will share with you in just a moment. But first, let's hear Louis on the subject of men and women just a few years ago in one of his specials.
How do women still go out with guys when you consider the fact that there is no greater threat to women than men? We're the number one threat to women. Globally and historically, we're the number one cause of injury and mayhem to women. We're the worst thing that ever happens to them. That's true. You know what our number one threat is? Heart disease. That's the whole thing. That's it. Just our own heart going, dude, you can't keep doing this. I told you 3 strokes ago that this is not smart. But women still think, yeah, I'll go out with you alone at night. What are you, nuts? I'll get in your car with you with my little shoulders. Hi, where are we going? To your death, statistically. How do they still do it? If you're a guy, try to imagine that you could only date a half bear, half lion. And I hope this one's nice. I hope he doesn't do what he's going to do.
Now, that's Louis C.K. just a few years ago. And now we know, based on his admissions today, that he was doing things around and to women that were completely inappropriate. We had the story in the New York Times just yesterday about these two women who back in 2002, Dana Min Goodman and Julia Wolof, who were at the U.S. Comedy Arts Festival in Aspen, and Louis, who was already well known for being a performer and writer on Letterman's show and Conan O'Brien's show. He invited them to hang out in his hotel room for a nightcap after they did their late night show. They said, okay, sure. They admired him. They were together. His intentions seemed collegial. And as soon as they sat down in the room, according to the Times, They were still wearing their winter jackets and hats, and Louis C.K. said, do you mind if I take out my penis? And then he really did it. They laughed as if it were a joke, and then he really did it, took all of his clothes off, got completely naked, and started playing with himself. 2003, similar thing happened with another woman who called Louis to invite him to one of her shows, and on the phone, she could hear him playing with himself as they spoke. Another woman said that while she was appearing with Louis C.K. on a television pilot in 2005, he asked if he could play with himself in front of her. Now, these are the kind of stories that when you hear them, your brain should go, oh! In fact, I just got an email from Linda in West County who says, Paul, maybe one of these days you could find some guest to put on air who could explain psychologically what men get out of being watched as they play with their junk. Being female, I don't get the thrill, frankly. We women don't do that. I simply do not understand the fascination, satisfaction, or whatever with guys who have to have an audience. It seems dumb to me. And as I've said many times before, no one wants to see our junk. No one. In September, these accusations were kind of floating around. They've been around for years. These stories from 2002 and 2003, they had been shared by these women with others, and it was known in the comedy community. But when they started popping up again in September, Louis said, oh, those are all just rumors. Well, today, here's the full statement he issued. I want to address the stories told to the New York Times by five women named Abby, Rebecca, Dana, Julia, who felt able to name themselves and one who did not. These stories are true. At the time, I said to myself that what I did was okay because I never showed a woman my junk without being asked first, which is also true. He doesn't say junk, by the way. I'm substituting it for the D word. He goes on to say, but what I learned later in life too late is that when you have power over another person, asking them to look at your junk isn't a question. It's a predicament for them. The power I had over these women is that they admired me, and I wielded that power irresponsibly. I have been remorseful of my actions, and I've tried to learn from them and run from them. Now I'm aware of the extent of the impact of my actions. I learned yesterday the extent to which I left these women who admired me feeling badly about themselves and cautious around other men who would never have put them in that position. I also took advantage of the fact that I was widely admired in my and their community, which disabled them from sharing their story and brought hardship to them when they tried because people who look up to me didn't want to hear it. I didn't think that I was doing any of that because my position allowed me not to think about it. There's nothing about this I can forgive myself for. And I have to reconcile it with who I am, which is being nothing compared to the task I left them with. I wish I had reacted to their admiration of me by being a good example of them as a man and giving them some guidance as a comedian, including because I admired their work. The hardest regret to live with is what you've done to hurt someone else, and I can hardly wrap my head around the scope of hurt I brought on them. I'd be remiss to exclude the hurt that I've brought on people who I work with and have worked with, whose professional and personal lives have been impacted by all of this, including projects currently in production, like the cast and crew of Better Things and Baskets and The Cops and One Mississippi and I Love You, Daddy. I deeply regret that this has brought negative attention to my manager, Dave Becky, who only tried to mediate a situation that I caused. I have brought anguish and hardship to the people at FX who have given me so much, and The Orchard who took a chance on my movie, and every other entity that has bet on me through the years. I have brought pain to my family, my friends, my children, and their mother. I have spent my long and lucky career talking and saying anything I want. I will now step back and take a long time to listen. Thank you for reading. That's Louis C.K.'s statement this afternoon. I will point out that he does not say he's going into therapy, and there's criticism on the Twitterverse of people about saying, well, he doesn't say he's going to therapy because he doesn't need therapy. Just like Harvey Weinstein doesn't need therapy. You have to stop acting like that. That's all. It's like that old Bob Newhart Mad TV skit. Doctor, I don't want to do this anymore. Then don't do that anymore.
You don't have to be talked out of it. You just have to stop the behavior.
Exactly.
Just don't do that anymore.
Exactly. You apparently now understand the implications of what you've been doing. So now that you know that, simply stop doing that.
Do you think that Louis C.K. is in a unique position to recover from this because of his stand-up routine, which has been about making people uncomfortable, that in the next 5 years or so, he could do a special, a comedy special, which he distributes himself on his website, which is how he made his fame anyway,
because
before any kind of deal. So if everybody drops him, if HBO, Netflix, FFX, if they all drop him, it doesn't really matter.
And Netflix has dropped him.
And HBO is looking at dropping him.
No, they
as
did
well.
Drop
they
him. Drop he was going to be on Night of Too Many Stars, the Jon Stewart thing for autism.
It doesn't matter, because he, the reason why we know the name Louis C.K. is because he started self-distributing his material on his website, and he made millions of dollars.
But he still has to do a special that people have to attend. You think if he were, if he came to St. Louis and said, I'm going to be doing a special at the Peabody 5 years from now, people would show up? 3,000 people?
I would not be surprised if he, in releasing this statement, thinks that he can overcome this.
You think that's why he released the statement? Or do you think he actually had a moment there where he said, oh, wow, I got to come clean about this?
You know, I don't want to, I can't get inside of his head, of course, and I don't want to sound too cynical or too cruel about it, but in the same way that people would say, hey, Harvey Weinstein, couldn't you have just paid a sex worker? You know, why are, you know, you have all this money? Well, it's because it was about power.
It's abuse of power.
And Louis C.K., could have also hired a prostitute and said, hey, I'm going to do this in front of you now.
Yeah.
Act like you're all shocked and let's role play. But no, it was the actual uncomfortable moment that you want. And
that got him off.
Well, it's also been his entire career. You look at all of his comedy. He has talked about his junk in his routine nonstop.
Yes.
And I know it's a slightly different circumstance, but Richard Pryor joked about freebasing cocaine in his act after he lit his head on fire.
But he was the victim there.
I understand that, but I'm saying I think that in releasing this statement, he's the only person so far to acquiesce and say, yes, I did this. Nobody else has. Everybody else, whether it's Weinstein or Bill Cosby
or Roy Moore,
has said, no, not me.
Yep.
So he is getting out in front of this sort of to say, yes, I did this. I'm going to take a step back. I think that he thinks he can overcome this.
Do you think this makes it up to those women in any way?
I can't pretend to know how they would feel. I do think acknowledging wrongdoing does help. Perhaps
it's better than saying, no, I didn't.
Absolutely. It's better than possibly a Roy Moore. I mean, if those allegations are correct, then yes. So in the short term, yes, I do believe that saying I did this stuff because it validates their anguish and their pain. And as you pointed out, Paul, if he simply doesn't do this anymore in 10 years and 15 years, do we have Louis C.K. back? Because again, who are we just talking about during the break? Mel Gibson. And Mel Gibson, who drank a whole lot and started talking about the Jews are running everything, and now he's in a comedy. And I didn't think that was going to happen.
No, I didn't either.
After what he said to his ex-girlfriend on that tape, you and I both heard what he said.
Yep.
I can't believe that he's at least attempting to make a comedy.
I got a better one for you, Roman Polanski.
Well, absolutely.
Left the country, still has not been prosecuted for raping a 14 or 15-year-old girl.
And won an Oscar.
Yeah.
So,
and Hollywood continued to nominate him.
This movie, I Love You, Daddy, which was supposed to have a premiere today. Of course, that premiere did not happen. I feel bad for the small film company, The Orchard, who paid $5 million to distribute the movie. And I'm sure they're just going to have to write that off as a tax write-off.
No, they've got insurance.
True, but I feel bad for them because they paid for that. Well, this movie, which I just watched the trailer for today, I had not seen the trailer. I normally don't watch
trailers. I heard it was creepy, was it?
Well, the thing about it is, I think it would have been creepy anyway because that's what Louis C.K. does with his act. Of course, now, with these facts, not even allegations, with these facts coming out, it's way more creepy and uncomfortable to watch. But look at this cast. He's got Rose Byrne, Edie Falco, Helen Hunt, Pamela Alden, and Chloe Grace Moretz. Those are all the women in the movie. You've got John Malkovich and Charlie Day. Very talented people in this film. This was supposed to be his version of Manhattan, the classic Woody Allen film. And
even has the same kind of old man, young woman thing.
Yeah, and it's black and white. So it was definitely his riff on that kind of a film. What's interesting about this is the movie has been pulled. I don't know if it's ever going to be released, at least not in the recent,
in the near future.
Thank you, in the near future. But screeners have gone out to critics.
Yep.
And I receive screeners. I've got a couple at home right now. War of the Planet of the Apes, Despicable Me 3, Beauty and the Beast. I wonder if I'll get a copy of this movie that might not even be released for 5 or 10 years. Almost like the day that the clown cried, the Jerry.
Yeah,
Jerry
that Lewis. Never went to the screener stage, though.
True. And this one was cutting it close because the premiere was supposed to be today.
Yeah.
So, I don't know what will happen to the movie. I don't know what will happen to his career. But if I'm being cynical, I think he thinks he can overcome this.
We'll take a break and come back with more of the Showbiz Show right after this on the Big 550 KTRS. Seems like all the showbiz news today is related to sexual harassment charges. More of them about Jeremy Piven, the former Entourage star. And two years ago, I was praising an Amazon series called Good Girls Revolt, which was just a terrific period drama about the beginnings of feminism in the late 60s and early 70s. And it ran for one season on Amazon. Then it was canceled by Roy Price, who was himself later canceled by Amazon when some sexual harassment charges came out against him. And now Sony, which made the original show, is talking about going back and producing it again because now there's a woman in charge at Amazon. Now, all of this brings us to about a minute we can talk about Kevin Spacey, who has been replaced in this movie that's going to open up in 6 weeks called All the Money in the World. The director, Ridley Scott, says, I know the movie's almost locked, but I'm going to take Kevin Spacey out and put Christopher Plummer in. What do you think of this?
It's an unprecedented move for a film that is going to be released just weeks away. That there were already talk about an awards campaign for Kevin Spacey for his work as J. Paul Getty. But Ridley Scott is one of the few directors in Hollywood who can pretty much call his own shots. He's got final edit. And he wanted to cast Christopher Plummer in this movie originally. And Sony said, no, we have to have somebody more bankable. How about Kevin Spacey? So now Ridley Scott gets to make the movie he really wanted to make anyway.
And Kevin Spacey was made to look 70 in the movie with terrible prosthetics.
Now you don't
have to. Christopher Plummer's old enough.
And plus, he's Christopher Plummer. He just won Best Supporting Actor for Beginners a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And most of his scenes take place in solitary scenes anyway, so it's going to be easy for them to insert him.
Well, there are a couple of scenes with Michelle Williams and Mark Wahlberg, who co-star in the movie, and they've said, yeah, I'll be more than happy to come back and shoot that with him.
And so now we're still going to have the movie making its original release date, and they're going to do an awards campaign for Christopher Plummer. How amazing if he would win for the role that was originally Spacey's.
That would be absolutely fantastic. And the last showbiz thing I want to mention is that Jennifer Aniston is coming back to television. She is going to do a series with Reese Witherspoon, who already has Big Little Lies on HBO, which has just been renewed.
Yeah.
Aniston and Reese Witherspoon are going to make a TV show about morning TV based on a book by Brian Stelter from CNN that he wrote when he was at the New York Times called Top of the Morning. I hope it's not as bad as the Harrison Ford, Rachel McAdams movie from 7 years
Morning
ago
Glory.
Called Morning Glory. Oh, boy, was that bad. But this is going to be Jennifer Aniston's first time on TV in 14 years, unless you count every commercial break that she's currently in.